across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
50,000 people sitting on a housing waiting list, nearly 50,000. And so what are we doing? Well, we've got 19,000 homes that can't be built because of the shortage, really, in the ability in the water supply. So is Stormont really punching through? Is Stormont said, right, let's sort this because we've got roofs over our heads if we're a politician and we're on our 40 or 50 or whatever it is, grand a year that an MLA gets, and radio presenters like me on quite a lot of money, and I have a roof over my head, and lots of you will, but the people that don't, or the people that are in squalid conditions, how sick must this make them? 19,000 houses that could be built. We don't have the water supply. Are we doing enough about it? Well, we'll have a look at what John O'Dowd's doing. There's that story coming up this morning as well. The farmers, they'll be out protesting tonight. We're talking to some farmers on the programme. And so it goes on. The jungle, it's back. Big Audrey sitting watching it. Glued to it last night. All coming up on the Nolan Show. I was about to grunt there or something because I've just got these pains in my legs this morning. 51, I'm falling apart. No doubt Holly's waiting, or who else will be waiting? Taggart? Crullers won't take over the show, will he? Imagine Crullers coming in here in his cravat and his wee socks. My lot, they don't even wash their face before they come in the morning. Crullers would be disgusted. All coming up on the Nolan Show today. The Stephen Nolan Show! Morning. So what is going on in terms of those people that are sitting on a housing waiting list? 50,000, nearly 50,000 people sitting on that housing waiting list. And meanwhile, in the great mighty Northern Ireland, with the great mighty Stormont, do you remember what we were promised? If only we had local politicians in place in order to sort out local problems. Well, it's dead on for me, isn't it? And it's dead on for all of you, and it's dead on for Minister John O'Dowd, every one of us who have a roof over our head. But for the nearly 50,000 people who are either in dilapidated housing or they don't have a house at all, nearly 50,000 of them, what are they hearing this morning? Well, there are 19,000 new homes on hold because of our water supply. On hold. 19,000. How must that make the people who are waiting on new housing feel? Is there any momentum within the executive? Is there anybody punching through with big ideas? What is Minister John O'Dowd going to do about it? As soon as we announced, we contacted Department of Infrastructure yesterday. We asked them to get in contact with us by 8 o'clock this morning. As soon as we announced at 9 o'clock today, we're running the story. Boom, statement drops. Northern Ireland Water was fully funded, they say, for the first 3 years of the current price control. While during this financial, we'll take time to read through this statement. While during the financial year, Minister O'Dowd has provided Northern Ireland Water with a budget allocation of almost $500 million, representing just under 40% of the total non-ring fence budget for the Department of Infrastructure. The Minister will be making an announcement about additional funding for NI Water so that it can address the pressure it is facing, including those relating to wastewater infrastructure. Now, that's interesting because Sarah Venning, who is the head of NI Water, told members at the Stormont Infrastructure Committee that NI Water have been asked to plan with a budget of nearly half of what is needed. Sam McBride from the Belfast Telegraph with us today. Well, look, we're looking for ideas. We're looking for these politicians to fix things that are broken in this country, Sam. Is housing being fixed?
Good morning, Stephen. Well, this ultimately comes down to something that most of us, frankly, don't want to think about. When we wash the dishes, when we flush the toilet, we know that there is dirty water going into the system and we just want it taken away from us. That's what most of us want to happen, in the same way that we put something into the black bin. We want it off our property and we don't want to think too deeply about where it goes. And that's been going on for years here, both from us as the public, but also from Stormont. So it's been very popular to say no water charges, no extra rates bill. bill for any of these major services. We've now got to the point where that is fine. We can have that if we want, but there are consequences to it. And the consequences are that in huge parts of Northern Ireland, nothing can be built, literally nothing. And it's not just houses, it's schools, it's new medical facilities, it's factories. There is such a constraint on the system. There is nothing there. And even if the money is found today, that's not going to be resolved for a very, very long time. So this is a crisis. It's been there for a very, very significant period building. Now it's at a point where it can't be hidden. And it's, of course, got major environmental problems. But the more pressing issue, I think, for a lot of people is having a roof over their head. And that is something that's going to get worse and worse and worse before it gets better.
So places, I should know this, Sam, and I didn't. So places in Northern Ireland where not one house can be built. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes. So earlier this year, at the start of the summer, NI Water did some pretty chilling briefings for major developers in Northern Ireland. They did this privately, but some of those documents I got hold of, and they showed basically that there is a moratorium on building where they will simply say you're not allowed to build. So when the planners come to consult NI Water and say, can you handle this? They will put a big red stamp on that application and say, no, it can't happen. Now, if you had a situation where planners or councillors were to pass that anyway, that's not going to resolve things because there is genuinely a problem here. This is not, and nobody has suggested that this is NI Water making this up. There genuinely is a situation where in parts of Northern Ireland, there is no capacity in the system. And of course, we know what that leads to. It leads to sewers being thrown open, untreated sewage being flushed into Belfast Lough, being flushed into Lough Neagh, being flushed into rivers. So it's not even a solution if somebody was to come in and say, look, we'll override that. It's OK. You can do it. There would be massive problems with that. But as things stand, yes, in 23 cities, towns, villages across Northern Ireland, certainly at the start of the summer, and it may well be worse than this because it was going up almost on a weekly basis at that point when I looked at this, there is no development whatsoever, save for one tiny little aspect of this, which is if you've got a very unusual situation where maybe a factory is shut in a town and there's a plan for development there where you can build on that site and it doesn't add to the sewage load. So maybe that factory used a lot of water and you can make an argument that you're not actually adding to the load. But almost in every situation in those places, and this is much of Northern Ireland, it's really much of Belfast, Londonderry, Ballymena, Inniskillen, Newton Abbey, Portadown. I mean, there's lots of really major conurbations where this impacts. And
so where, Sam, just really, run over again where houses can't be built, where in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's much of Belfast, much of Londonderry, much of Ballymena, Inniskillen, Newton Abbey, Portadown.
What?
There are other smaller places.
Where's gridlock then?
Yeah, and look, there are about 37,000 buildings in the system that NI Water is aware of that are coming down the track. There are some mechanisms where if you're wanting to make a major development happen, you go to NI Water at an early stage so they have a sense of what's happening. And of those 37,000, almost 19,000, so more than half, will not be able to get built because they can't connect. So that's about half of what's coming down the line. And of course, what's coming down the line in Northern Ireland is nowhere near enough. We're at record lows since the Second World War for building houses. So even our current plans are hopeless. And of those, more than half of them can't be built.
So the people at the top, they're bidding for their fancy houses and they're all right, Jack. Meanwhile, the people at the bottom of the earning cycle in Northern Ireland, or indeed at the bottom in terms of having a fancy house, they don't even have a roof over their head. They're sitting there, they're on a waiting list, and our executive is doing what to fix this? Now, I see in the statement that's just dropped from the Department for Infrastructure, Minister O'Dowd, they say, Sam, is taking a three-pronged approach. He's reviewing the policy. Well, what's the outcome of that? Legislation around developer contributions. Well, that's about developers paying more, isn't it? He's secure executive agreement for the water flooding and sustainable drainage bill to be introduced to the Assembly. But if the infrastructure is not there, how quickly can we fix it, Sam? Is it just about money? And how quickly will that money buy a solution to this?
Well, lots of what John O'Dowd is saying there is actually very sensible. So that sustainable drainage is about things like if you are building a house, you try to limit the load on the wastewater system. So you don't tarmac over the whole driveway. You let some of the water that falls naturally from rainfall seep down into the ground. You separate out wastewater, which comes from things like toilets and is obviously very dirty and needs to have lots of treatment, from water which falls in rainfall on the road and can simply be given either very little treatment or put straight into a river. So there's lots of that is very sensible, but it's not going to solve this. There's also something there which is hinted at but isn't spelt out, and that's that John O'Dowd is looking at the idea of basically passing a lot of the bill for this onto developers. And what that means is that we've got water charges by the back door. It's not going to be water charges for me because I live in a house that is already built. It's not going to be water charges for you because you live in a house that is already built. But if you want to buy a house, the developer who's building it and is going to sell it to you is going to get an extra bill for possibly tens of thousands of pounds. We don't know yet exactly what that will be. And ultimately, what do you think a developer is going to do? They're going to pass that on to the person buying it.
That's going to push first-time buyers out of the market yet again. That's going to drive house prices up yet again for people who are just starting out to buy their first house.
For some people, that will be too much and it will put them out of the market. For lots of people, it won't. They'll be able to get a mortgage. It'll be a bit extra, but it'll be something they'll be able to pay. What it will be is unequal. So it will mean that those who are starting out or wanting to buy a new house for whatever reason, they're going to get this huge upfront bill, huge in relative terms. It's relatively small in comparison to what people pay for houses, if it's 20, 30,000 pounds, but it's still a lot of money. It will not be spread equitably in terms of any sort of system of charging where the rich pay more, where the poor pay less, and where it's spread year by year or where it's based on how much water you actually use. None of that. That'll all be out the window. This will simply be a big sum that's paid up front. So it's not really a terribly elegant solution, but because Stormont can't agree to do anything else and they are terrified of anything that looks like water charges, this seems to be the only thing they're actually going to do to raise more serious money.
Mr. Dowd isn't available to speak to us this morning, but are you sure he won't be pushing back against people like you describing this as water charges by the back door? Water charges in themselves, that would spread the cost equally among the rich and the poor. As you're describing here, this is going to be loaded, if that's how they do it, towards the young people buying their first homes, towards those people who have never been on the housing ladder. There's no way a Sinn Féin minister is going to accept how you're describing this.
No, and look, he certainly will not describe this in any way with a phrase which uses the words water charges. He will say this is about making developers pay. He might even try to claim that that should come out of developers' profits. He's got no way of implementing that. All he can do is say that there has to be more money raised and it's coming from developers. And I think most of us know that in a capitalist system, developers will do whatever they can to keep their profits where they are. That's the system we're in. You might like it, you might not like it. That's what we all know is going to happen. It will be passed on. It will be people buying new houses who will take that hit. And so ultimately, of course, that is by the back door water charges. But it's a big lump sum. I mean, it's certainly fundamentally different to what most people think of as water charges. Well, once you pay it, it's not going to come back at you unless it turns out that money isn't enough and then they have to do something else to raise money. But yes, it is a charge and it's a charge for water infrastructure.
Well, John O'Dowd is saying in this statement, Sam, that his department have given to the Nolan Show, the minister will be making an announcement about additional funding for Northern Ireland Water so that it can address the pressures it's facing, including those relating to wastewater infrastructure. So there's more money out of the October monitoring round going to NI Water.
There is. And look, that is not insignificant. There was more money there than Stormont expected to get from London. So in some ways, that makes it slightly better than it would have been. But earlier this summer, what NI Water was saying was that it had a day-to-day budget shortfall of about £40 million. And a capital budget, and that's the key one that we're talking about here, because that's about building new infrastructure to try to make things better. The shortfall there was £145 million. So that's £185 million in total of a black hole this year. And we're what? more than halfway through the current financial year, or roughly around that. And so what they've got in the monitoring round for John O'Dowd's department, which of course does roads, does potholes, does all sorts of other things, it's not just about water, he has got £39 million of capital funding, and I think it's 24 million pounds, I think it was, day-to-day spending, if I've got that figure right. But certainly it's about £39 million of capital. They need £145 million. So, I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. It is nothing like what they need. Everybody knows that. And so that's why he's looking at these other things that will bring in much, much bigger sums of money.
Well, Mark H. Durkin, listening to this. Sam, stay there if you can. I want to ask you one other thing in a minute or two. SLP MLA, Mark Durkin. Good morning to you, Mark. Good morning, Mark. Okay, Mark clearly not there. We'll see if we can get him back. 030-30-80-55-55. Sam, but before you go then, this morning, I read a story you were talking about in fact, Mark H. Durkin is with us now. Mark, good morning to you. Good morning, Mark.
Yes.
Good morning. There you are. Okay.
Hello.
Yes, Mark, we can hear you. But is anybody in Stormont?
Hello.
My goodness. Can you hear us, Mark?
Hello.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Well, some type of... we'll get it sorted. Sam, let me pass to you. You can hear me. I was reading some of your journalism over the weekend about civil servants and how they're being promoted. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, this relates to something that we had covered last year, where there were some figures which the SDLP had found, actually, which showed that about 10% of all civil servants in Northern Ireland are on temporary promotion. So a massive percentage of the civil service are not actually properly appointed through the normal processes. They're put into jobs which are in some cases very significant, but they haven't gone through the rigorous open competition that you might expect from a body like the civil service. There was one person last year who had been temporarily promoted for more than 18 years. Now, think about that. Somebody who has been temporarily promoted for longer than I've been a journalist. There are massive problems with this. If you are not going through proper competition, you can get round fair employment law potentially. You can have cronyism. You can have a manager who rewards somebody. These people get the full salary, the full financial benefits of their new position, but they're not going through the process that ought to happen there. So when I wrote about this last year, the civil service said, hands up, there is a problem here. They blamed it on budgets. They blamed it on various things. They said they were going to address it. This year, it turns out that it has gone up. It's got worse. We're now up to more than 11% of the civil service are on temporary promotion. They finally, just about 2 weeks ago, I think, managed to get this person who's been acting up for now 19 and a half years. They finally managed to sort that out. But that's the exception. Most of these cases are not being resolved. There are people, lots of people there who have been temporarily promoted for maybe more than 4 years, and all sorts of stories coming in. And it's just one little window into how broken the civil service is. After the RHI inquiry, after the COVID inquiry, we've had Jane Brady, the head of the civil service, saying we're going to change, we're going to reform, we're going to get better. And you've just got this shambolic system, and it's failing ministers, it's failing us. And yet you look at the programme for government, Stormont's sort of roadmap for what they want to do, and there's no mention of the civil service there. There's vague references to trying to reform the public service. But actually what they're going to be doing is getting these people who are not reformed, telling the health service, telling the education service, telling all the other parts of our public sector how they should reform themselves. And this body can't reform itself.
Should the public smell a rat here? Are they deliberately not reforming it so that they can promote whoever they want to rather than going through the proper procedures? Is it deliberate, or is it down to some type of laziness, or what? Why haven't they reformed it? Why are they not doing it properly?
Look, I can't say that they're doing this deliberately because I don't have evidence for that. But what I can say is that multiple civil servants, serving civil servants, have been in touch with me saying that they think there is something fishy about this. They see it close up. Some of these people have gone through the rigorous process. They've been passed for promotion to a substantive post, and they're sitting for months, some of them more than 6 months, waiting to get those posts. And they look around them and their boss hasn't gone through that, or their colleagues haven't gone through that, and they are being handed these posts and they're very suspicious of that.
Okay, Sam McBride, thank you very much as always. 0330 80 55 55. I'm going to take a big gulp here, see if Mark H. Durkin can hear us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Stephen.
Ah, there you are, the STLP MLA, Mark H. Durkin. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Stephen. I did lose you for a wee while there, so I missed some of what Sam was saying.
I did hear him
outline quite well the issues facing Northern Ireland Water and the supposed consequential issues facing us as a society.
Well, totally. Totally. You have 19,000 building projects on hold. You have the head of NI Water, Sarah Venning, saying that the Northern Ireland Water system is at breaking point. She said this to Sunday Politics yesterday. So is there any sign of them getting together at Stormont, seeing this as urgent and fixing it, or at least attempting to fix it?
Well, you have covered quite well there the impact that this is having on housing, with 19,000 houses that we know of not being able to be built. Put that in contrast to the staggering numbers of people on the housing list. I mean, I've lamented the lack of ambition and the lack of budget for a social housing build programme to address that housing crisis, and it's being exacerbated greatly by the issues facing Northern Ireland Water. So really, action does need to be taken, and it needs to be taken now to get this situation under control, because it's not just housing either. I mean, this is having a serious impact on our economy. You have businesses unable to expand. You have businesses making decisions to set up shop or set up factories elsewhere because they're unable to get connections here. And then you look at issues like the city and growth deals. Many of them will be reliant on major projects that will require, therefore, major infrastructural works and put more pressure on this system. I think even of the expansion of the university in Derry here, which is a programme for government commitment as well, and it will be inhibited by the lack of ability to connect with water infrastructure. So it is something that needs sorted, and it's been a historic issue. I mean, the Northern Ireland Audit Office carried out a report, and in that report they recommended that DFI and Northern Ireland Water conduct a thorough review of alternative funding and governance arrangements. This review should be led by qualified experts and explore sustainable solutions for long-term investment in water infrastructure. And now we, as the opposition, the SDLP, we support that independent review of Northern Ireland Water, and we're open to hearing what those experts have to say. However, we must be convinced, and I will say this, that it won't result in additional costs for people. Like, further hardship can
be families
struggling to make ends meet.
So where does the money come from?
The executive has to prioritise investment in critical infrastructure. Well, that's why we have to hear what the experts are saying. Mutualisation is an issue that has been floated, and I've heard it explained previously on your show.
O'Dowd has ruled it out.
Quite well. Well, we have to hear from the Minister why he's ruling it out, why he's not even hearing it as a recommendation. Like, there are quite a few arguments for mutualisation. You know, it would increase investment flexibility.
This is a long-term problem,
Mark,
isn't it?
Yes, could potentially provide long-term stability.
But this is a long-term problem. This goes back years, right?
Yes.
And there was, from memory, there was an SDLP infrastructure minister until 2022. What have you not been doing about it?
No. Yes, there was. Nicola Mallon was infrastructure minister from 2020 to 20. two years during a global pandemic, during which time Nicola actually championed the issue of Northern Ireland water. She brought the price control plan that we've been talking about, the 2027, to the executive, where it was agreed. Okay, so they agreed what Northern Ireland water would need every year.
But that's what they would need, but you're ruling out people having to pay for it. So where does the money come from?
And we have just heard that for the first 3 years of that, it has been funded. But now we've hit the buffers. And this is why, despite what the Minister's saying, and we do welcome, he's demonstrating a bit of innovation around us. He's talking about developer contributions. That's tinkering at the edges a bit here, and nor is it cost neutral, as Sam has outlined there. This will impact in on the cost of building houses. It will mean fewer social houses can be built. It will mean that the price of houses in the private market will increase. That will push up rents, and it will actually do very little
benefits
to
people.
Address the housing crisis that we have
and
here.
And it benefits it. Therefore, the outworking of this is people who do not have a home yet, they will be paying more, as Sam has intimated. And those people sitting in the big houses, guess what? They'll be making more. Their houses will be more valuable. And also, what have we done? We've raised the rates for those people on the big houses, but we haven't lifted the cap completely. So once again, the rich get richer. James in Lisburn. Morning, James.
Morning, Stephen. How's it going?
Go ahead, James.
Stephen, this has been going on for years. I moved into a new development in 2011, and pay £250 a year on top of my rates, and they say that £250 is
service charge. There you go.
So now they're just creeping in the water. I think I was on with Freddie saying they're having to rob Peter to pay Paul about the nurses and whatever else. This is just another way of getting more money. I've been paying £250 a year in a new development to cover green areas, so the grass gets cut by private companies. Private companies come in to take the bins out in apartment blocks, street lighting and the roads. I haven't even got a road into my house yet. It's still a gravel track.
I think the territory you're talking about is really interesting, and I've been wanting to do this story for a while, James. You see these service charges that are quite common charges on apartments.
Yep.
But service charges now on developments of housing, and you're bound into that then, as you're describing, every year.
So whenever you put a £500 deposit down to hold the house, £250 goes straight to the service charge, and that's you under the contract.
Yeah. So who's controlling them? Who's scrutinising them? Can they charge what they want? Can these service charges go up at the whim of the developer? These are all the type of things I want to look into.
And if you stop paying that service charge, whenever you go to sell your house, that service charge will be taken off the value you sell your house.
That's right.
Whatever you owe that company,
that will
come off the house sale.
But who decides what the service charge is? And what's it actually buying you? What does it buy? It buys the grass being cut around that local development, doesn't it? But if you're paying rates to your local council, why is the council not doing that?
Well, this is what they're saying. They're saying that because it's still a development and they're still building on it, that it can't be handed over to the Department of Infrastructure, even though we still pay our rates. And do you know what it is? It's three wee lads on lawnmowers that do it maybe once a month, cut the grass once a month over the summer.
Right. Well, look, here's what we'll commit to do. If you're listening this morning, these service charges in developments of housing throughout Northern Ireland, if you want to send us in what's happening to you, nolan@bbc.co.uk is our email address, and we'll look at it at a future occasion. Mark H. Durkin's still with us this morning, right?
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a separate matter, and that is what Sam, you're the official opposition, your party is, Sam McBride telling us this morning about this situation, which sounds ludicrous, that with all the fair employment laws that there are, the people who should be sending the benchmark best practice, Stormont, They're giving people jobs on temporary promotions, and then those promotions last sometimes decades. What is going on? Why would they want to do that and send that signal to Northern Ireland? Is there something up?
Well, first, I just want to go back to one wee issue on the water. Stephen, you questioned, I suppose, what we had done when we were in government or what the SDLP had done. Sam had mentioned there, or the minister's statement mentions, that bringing forward legislation on sustainable urban drainage schemes. It was actually Nicola Mallon who opened the consultation on that has brought it to this stage. If Stormont won't raise revenue or it won't cut costs, it can borrow. Mutualisation or a restructuring of Northern Ireland water will allow it to do that. People shouldn't have to pay more for water, but people are paying for water in their rates. They need to know what they're paying. And Northern Ireland Water, if they could show what or see what people were paying, they'd know what they're getting, and they could go to private lenders to actually borrow money to do the work that they need to do. In terms of the temporary promotions, it was actually my colleague Daniel McCrossan on the Communities Committee who has been to the fore in highlighting this situation by asking questions around the number of temporary promotions, and it's a worsening picture. We haven't heard adequate answers from the Minister for Communities or any executive minister as to why this practice is so commonplace and why they're persisting with it. But it is a bad look, to say the least. It's bad practice. Stormont government departments should be leading by example, and this isn't how things should be done. It's not fair on anyone, least of all people employed in those departments as well, never mind people who are looking to and would be glad of a role in the civil service but are being denied the opportunity to apply.
It's the smell test, isn't it? Look, if someone is promoted temporarily and their position in that post runs over by a few weeks or a few months or maybe 6 months, then I dare say quite a few people listening to this might think to themselves, well, maybe it was a busy department, maybe other things were going on, etc., etc. But when someone is being temporarily promoted, Jane Brady, I would ask you this question as head of the civil service. Someone so-called temporarily promoted for what? 5 years? 6 years? 10 years? What's the whiff of that?
Well, like I say, as the opposition, we got a whiff of this and have done more to expose it. I don't doubt how busy all the departments are, but they do seem they've got themselves in a hole and they're keeping digging. And that's going to make it harder to get out of this.
What's it do for morale?
Action does need taken.
What does it do for the perception of those civil servants who maybe are equally as entitled to have a chance to go for that job, and they're looking at one of the favourites from the bosses? They're looking for one of the, you know, whoever's in the in crowd, sitting in a job where the full process has not been implemented. Like, what must it do for those civil servants? Mark,
oh, sorry.
That's to you, Mark.
Well, it isn't good for them. It's not good for morale. It's not good for the operation of any department or agency either. People need stability in their work, and government departments need to be stable to be able to deliver the public services that people here are paying for through their rates and through their taxes.
Okay. Mark, thank you very much indeed. We're a bit late for the news. Sorry about that. Here comes from the BBC. We'll talk about the farmers in a minute or two. We'll be out in their tractors protesting tonight. 22 minutes to 10, the Nolan Show from the BBC. Norman.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Stephen, you know what would make my day?
What?
I'm going to nominate you for get me out of here in the jungle.
The jungle?
Seeing you in a coffin with about 50 rats crawling over you. Because you're afraid of a wee mouse, I'd love to see the rats crawling over you.
I couldn't bear it. Do you know what's happening in my house? There's these big hairy spiders.
You're not afraid of a spider, are you?
I most certainly am. I had to, it was about 2 weeks ago now, I had to get a man who was in the house to lift it. I couldn't even lift it.
I lift them, the big ones. I get nipped on one day, so right, now I get a bit of tissue paper and put it around the spider, lift it, take it outside and put it outside.
I'll not be getting nipped. What do you call your man? Who is this man? Dean McCulloch from Radio 1.
Dean McCulloch, I radio. I think Barry McGuigan will win this.
Do you?
I do. That's who would be my choice.
But can you think of anything worse? Like, these people must really need the money. Can you think of anything worse than getting there and getting tormented by Ant and Dec and all those creepy crawlies, and you have to...
Well, that's why they're in it, Stephen, for the money. The money they're getting paid. What are they getting? Quarter of a million? Oh. Half a million?
Oh, now the spiders don't feel that dangerous to me. I would do it for a tenner and a slush puppy.
So look at Mike Tyson. He gets 15 million for getting into a boxing ring.
Well, that was a farce, wasn't it?
It was.
That boxing.
But you get in there for the money, and this is what it's all about, the money. What does Rooney's wife need the money for when he's a millionaire, really?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, money goes to money, Norman. But I'll not be doing it.
Doesn't it?
I'll not be doing it.
I'd love to see you in it, Stephen.
Not happening. Thank you, Norman. Brendan.
Right, Stephen.
Thank you. Morning. Brendan Curran. Good morning, Brendan. Member of the Unite Union. Morning to you about housing.
How you doing?
Doing okay, thank you.
Stephen, just on the management companies, we live in a development, and 13, 14 years ago, they told us that we'd have to sign up when we agreed a mortgage, which we did. Nothing happened. No management work was carried out on the development for practically 14 years. And then all of a sudden, this management company came out of nowhere telling us that they were looking forward to working with us and they were going to charge us money for doing stuff that they never done and that we were doing ourselves, the residents.
Yeah, these management charges, they're a whole story. I've done it before, Brendan, but the amount of people that talk to me about either management charges or these so-called service charges. And
this management company in particular, the person in charge of it she owned 50 management companies.
Well, then let's not talk any further, because I think you're just shortening that down, Brendan, to define who that person is, and we wouldn't want to do that in live radio unless we have all the details in front of us. Let's pass on to the farmers next. William Irvine, President of the Ulster Farmers Union. Morning to you, William.
Good morning, Stephen.
So there'll be a protest later today up at the base, will there? Will the farmers be on their tractors, or how's this going to look and feel?
No tractors involved tonight. This is about farm families coming together to register their despair at this unfair tax that has come from the budget. And it's all about sending a strong message to London. Myself and a delegation from the Ulster Farmers Union will be heading off early tomorrow morning to attend rallies in London. This problem started in London, and it's London-based folk that we need to influence here. But what we want tonight is a real strong united voice from Northern Ireland to say this is not on.
Well, there might not be a united voice, because some people might think that farmers should not get special treatment with inheritance tax. Many other people have to pay it. Why not you?
Farmers are the food security for the country. We work for... To survive, we get government support. And they're handing government support out, necessary government support out, and then they're taking it back off in this underhand way with this tax. And it's really sinister what's happening here. Every time a farm changes down a generation, this will come into play, and it will build, and it puts the future of the agriculture industry at risk.
Well,
agricultural industry feeds the country.
What you're actually saying, William, is you want subsidies and you want a buy ball with inheritance tax.
We want the ability to survive and continue doing what we do. If everybody, and like I realise this is not possible, but if everybody paid the true value of the food on the shelves, we wouldn't need these buy balls, as you call them. But that is not where the world's at. We as an industry are facing massive challenges, and actually facing up to massive challenge in a very positive and strong way around climate change, carbon emissions and all of that, but it all comes at a cost. And when we were fully stretched and fully focused on that issue, they've come at us with this.
What this comes down to, William, this doesn't affect any farms. In fact, Sir Keir Starmer, over the weekend, I was doing this on Five Live last night, the Prime Minister was saying last night that this will not affect the vast majority of farms in the country. And if you look at Treasury figures, their data is saying around three quarters of farmers will pay nothing in inheritance tax as a result of these changes.
Well, just on that point, Stephen, the Treasury came out with their impact assessment. The Department of Agriculture in England, DEFRA, they came out with a much worse impact statement. And when our own department here in Northern Ireland looked at it again, their interpretation was even worse again. And so there has been no joined-up thinking in this. Northern Ireland is very vulnerable to this in that we are predominantly owner-occupiers. We have the highest land values in the UK. And this tax sucks the will to invest and address all the issues that society wants us to address. We want to farm, we want to produce food, and we want to do it in an environmentally friendly way, but this ties our hands behind our back.
So let's, William, actually look at some of the figures, some of the data behind this. If a farmer is married, his or her spouse would be able to pass on another 1.325 million tax-free, right? So if you start off, there's no inheritance to be taxed on the value of a property up to 325 grand. The government is allowing the first million on farmland to be tax-free. So you've got 1.325 million if you're single farmer. Then if you're married, you've got another 1.325 million. So the total untaxed amount, 2.65 million. In addition, there's a 175 grand tax-free allowance on a main residence, which is being passed on to a farmer's children. So the total untaxed amount for a farming couple, up to £3 million. Now, for those people who won't come anywhere close to that, but have to pay inheritance tax, how much sympathy will there be for you and your farmers?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of a sympathy and public support for our position in this. It's highlighted actually that all political parties will be represented at our rally tonight, and they will all be supporting our position in this. When we talk to agricultural legal people involved in agricultural business, they say it is very rare for a family farm to tick all the boxes to get the reliefs you're talking about there. Families and farm businesses are much more complicated than that. Every situation's different. Deaths do not happen in chronological order. You know, accidents happen, health problems happen. There is the possibility that within one generation, this tax could be applied twice. So, the reason the government are doing this is to lift 500,000 out of the UK agriculture industry every year. And there's if land values move forward and increase, and you know that gets a bigger percentage year by year. So this is an unfair tax. We have looked at what happens around the rest of Europe. No other country around Europe has this regime in place because they all see the importance of food production.
Have a listen, William, to James and Temple Patrick. In fact, I'll let James speak to you. Morning, James.
Morning, Stephen.
You can say good morning to William.
Good morning, William. I have a real problem with this. First of all, I'm a landlord and I run a number of properties. If anything happens to me, I'll have to put people out in the street to pay inheritance tax, which is no different to you in terms of what you're doing. So why should you get any additional value or additional tax credits that we don't? And we could pay twice as well, because the government's plan is you pay inheritance tax, but also then they put that into your pension fund. So if your property is part of your pension fund, you'll not only pay capital gains tax, you'll pay inheritance tax as part of the pension fund as well. So we lose twice.
Yep, well, the difference here is in the most cases, these farms have been within families for generations.
So is my properties.
but we cannot produce food without land.
I'm going to put people on the street if I have to sell property to pay inheritance tax. People are going to be without a roof over their heads.
Well, let's let William finish his point.
But my point is, agriculture is the soul of rural Northern Ireland. We move 6 billion through the local economy that allows people to afford the rents for your houses. We are the heartblood of communities and those rural areas. And Northern Ireland would be so much poorer if that all fell away. Even the environment, a lot of the environmentalists want us to be properly funded so that we can deliver for society.
Ian,
with our land.
Ian in Saintfield has called us this morning. You're a farmer, Ian. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning.
Go ahead.
I only heard you a few wee points because I've just got into to go to feed animals, so I stopped here to speak to you.
What are you feeding?
I'm feeding sheep and cattle.
Ugh.
You made the point about how much a farm is worth and how much money there is.
Yeah.
But the point is that is being kept in. You know, that's being kept passed on to the next generation.
Well, you've got 50 acres, right?
Yes.
So you must be a multi-millionaire.
On paper, I'm a millionaire, and I am broke. You know, I work a year round, and the cash flow just about keeps everything up and going.
Seriously.
No.
So what type of money? What type of salary after all the costs? What type of salary would a farmer on 50 acres be making?
We wouldn't even be making the minimum wage. My wife has to go out and work. Not wants to go out and work, although she does, has to. Now, you were talking about the land, and it's worth so much. What would your reaction onto your programme be if Belfast City Council said that they were going to sell Ormo Park, which is an intergenerational asset of Belfast City Council that they hold for the people of Belfast? But what would happen if the councillors decided that they needed to sell it? Do you think there might be a wee bit of a fuss?
But you're comparing public property here to, at the end of the day, you are a private business, Ian.
Yes, but what I'm comparing is an asset that's owned by someone. Belfast City Council owns Ormond Park. And that is passed on from one council to the next. They don't actually see any benefit financially from that
park. Yes, but
park.
That's not a direct comparable because your family, Ian, obviously, you could decide to sell up at any time. If you sold up 50 acres of land, what have you got? A couple of million in the bank?
Wouldn't be as much as that, but...
Well, it would be a million,
but,
wouldn't
but
it?
What we
are doing...
You're a
millionaire. You are a millionaire. Aren't you?
I wish I lived like one.
But you're a millionaire choosing not to sell your land.
Yes, but if I did sell the land, other taxes would come into place. Capital gains tax.
Like the rest of us.
Like the rest of us, which no one has any problem with. It's whenever we die and pass on to the next generation, a generational thing.
Yeah.
Now, if...
No, I get that, to be fair. I get that. So hold on.
Hold on. Okay. If the Chancellor had said, right, we're going to put a thing that... That if a farmer sells his land, if someone sells land, agricultural land that they farm, and it's passed on to the next generation, and if they don't farm it as an active farmer, as decreed by the department here, if they don't do it for 5, 6, 7 years, 10 years,
yeah,
then the tax would come. You know,
yeah,
be,
no, I get this. I get it. And I do
that would be fair. That would be totally fair.
I hear you.
And it wouldn't be a problem.
And I do want to be reasonable with you this morning. What you're essentially saying is, look, you might have a million quid's worth of land, but if you sell up, then the farm's gone. That legacy within your family, the opportunity for the next generation to farm that land, it is gone. And that's why it doesn't matter whether you've got a million or 10 million quid's worth of land. It's only worth that in terms of hard cash if you ever sell. And then you lose your business. I hear you.
That must be one. The thought of selling the farm, I haven't actually really thought about it. But the gut wrench that you just put into my stomach about selling the family farm. We have been farming in this country since 1603. okay? That's whenever my generation came across from Scotland. And the thought of not passing on to the next generation and passing on in a better state, which because of everything that's coming down the line, I probably won't. The farm won't be in as good a state as whenever I got it. Financially or anything. It definitely won't be in a better state financially. But that's what drives us.
Can I say something without being cheeky?
Yeah,
because I'm genuinely thinking this. You're getting up early in the morning. You know, the muck and the dirt and the smell, it actually made me sick when I went on to a farm. This clip is hundreds of thousands of hits on it. It's probably more now on YouTube, right? Did it years ago.
Yeah.
If you're all saying the same thing, which is very few of you are making minimum wage, very few of you are making money, why are you doing it? It doesn't add up to me.
It's a disease. It's an addiction. You have to be... You can't make somebody farm. I look around my neighbour farms.
I can't think of anything worse.
No, but I over my lifetime, I've saw various farms where the older generation have stopped farming or have retired or died. And the next generation, one of the first things they do is sell up because they never wanted to farm. They farm just because of it. And you know, it could well be that I'll pass my farm on to the next generation and they'll sell it. And they'll pay capital gains tax, or they'll pay that. That's fine. That's the same as everybody else. But if Belfast City Council wanted to sell a bit of brown field site, that they'd pay tax on that. I would hope. But if you know a national asset, our land is an asset, and if we break our family farms up into unviable units, we're not talking about now. We're talking about two or three generations down the line. We won't have, and don't forget, what's the biggest business in Northern Ireland? Agriculture. And which department is the last picked every time? Agriculture and environment. The political parties love agriculture and the environment so much that it's the last pick.
Have you more sympathy now, James, and Temple Patrick, listening to this?
Well, no, Stephen, because what they're asking for is some preferential treatment. And the issue behind that is very simple. And as a landlord, we're not making millions of pounds either, so please don't forget that in terms of people believe landlords are creaming profits, because we're not.
Well, some of you are.
Well, again, Stephen, you've just made the issue. Don't judge everybody by one or two people. So 80% of landlords own only one property. One. Most of those they have inherited just like the farmers. And they are being asked to, when they sell or whatever else, they've got to pay their capital gains. They've got to pay their inheritance tax just like the farmers. We are just, like many other businesses, trying to pass on something that we've worked hard all our life for to our children.
William Irvine, no sympathy from James this morning.
No, and but by and large, we are getting a lot of public support. Just on the income figures, the Department of Agriculture's figures for last year's average farm income was $37,500.
That's way more than minimum wage.
Well, 80% of that come from public support because the price of the goods we're selling wasn't getting fair value.
37 grand.
Subsidise you.
37 grand for getting up, sticking your fists and fingers and all of that.
Yeah. But the £1 million relief and possibly a wee bit more than £1 million if all the boxes can be ticked. That really only covers relatively small farms. The farms that employ two and three family members are that really produce the food that feeds this country.
Let's see if we can get Martin and Belfast in.
They will be severely impacted.
Morning, Martin.
This.
Morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
No, I have a very sympathy for the farmer as well, but I say I am a landlord myself, and as I was saying to your researcher there, if I buy a property, I'm charged stamp duty on it, which is a form of taxation. I then let that house out, and any profit I make on it, I have to pay tax on it, right? Then when I sell the house, if I do sell the house, I have to pay capital gains tax on it, which is a fourth form of taxation.
Yeah, only if you make money.
But But then when I actually pass that on, when I die to my family, they pay inheritance tax. That's four forms of taxation. Four. Is that fair? At the end of the day, I'm providing a service the same way as the farmer is. And this is something that my parents were in this business. I'm in this business. Hopefully, if God spares us, my family will go into this business.
So what are you going to do? Are you going to jump on board with the farmers and back them? Or are you going to pillory them?
I'm not pillorying them. I'm not. I'm just saying that, you know, I'm saying that it's a ridiculous situation that we're in. You know, we're being hammered. And then people talk about the greedy landlords. All they do is sit back and lift money. If they only knew the half of it, Stephen.
Martin, thank you. William Irvine, thank you. Ian, thank you. 030 30 80 55 55. Here comes the 10 o'clock news now from the Nolan Show on the BBC. No, I'm supposed to be out working overnight tonight. Snow. Tell me it's not coming to Belfast, please. I'm too old for all this malarkey. I remember Eamon Holmes telling me that once you hit 50, you start to feel pains where you've never felt them before. It's bang on the money. I'm 51 now. You're up in the morning, your legs are sore, your arms are sore. There's going to be cold weather tonight. Anyway, good morning to you all. 4 minutes past 10. It's the Nolan Show from BBC Radio Ulster. Do you remember back in April of this year, masked men were pictured inside Roselawn Crematorium during a funeral of a former UDA man? Well, it seems that Belfast City Council have stepped up security patrols at Roselawn. What difference is this going to make? Well, let's speak to our political reporter, Brendan Hughes. Morning, Brendan. What have they done?
Morning, Stephen. Well, just to give some background of these incidents, first of all, as you mentioned, there was one incident that happened at late April / early May. That's when it was first reported by the Belfast Telegraph. There were pictures that emerged of masked men standing over a coffin inside the crematorium. These pictures showed three masked men dressed in dark jackets and wearing dark glasses and berets. And it's believed that this happened at the funeral of a former UDA man at the end of April. Now, there was also a second incident in August. That was when it was alleged that there were men seen at a graveside wearing paramilitary style uniforms. That was after a report was made of men at a graveside wearing white shirts, some sort of symbols on their ties, as well as wearing black armbands. Now, police and the council investigated both of these incidents, and those investigations have since been closed. In terms of what they said, well, the PSNI has said that inquiries were made. These investigations have since been closed, pending further evidence being received by police, which will then be dealt with accordingly. So effectively, police are saying, well, we've taken this as far as we can go for now. As for the council, it says that both council investigations have now concluded, that party group leaders on the council have been updated, and in terms of their assessment of these incidents, they say that the incident in May was an unauthorised display inside their facility, while the incident in August was found not to be paramilitary in nature. But in response to concerns around both of these, the council says that a number of internal actions have been put in place to improve site security and ensure, they say, that Roselawn Cemetery and Crematorium operate effectively as places of reflection for bereaved families and visitors. So just in terms of what does this mean, what are these security actions? Well, the council hasn't given specifics about what has been done, but it's understood this is more about making internal processes more robust. So it's not about putting in place new infrastructure in terms of things like CCTV cameras or more security infrastructure in that respect. This is more about things like regular patrols of the grounds, the attempts to strengthen their internal staff processes for handling and reporting incidents when they arise. So it's really about improving communication, ensuring that staff know what should be reported, when it should be reported, to whom it should be reported, and so if there are any future incidents or issues that happen at Roselawn Crematorium and Cemetery, that those issues are quickly dealt with by the council processes.
Was the CCTV working at the time?
That's not something that I'm aware of, Stephen, whether it was CCTV that would have covered the crematorium or the cemetery. The the council hasn't given further information as to what their investigation found out or what the police investigation has found out. But what we can see from these statements from both the council and the PSNI is that they have taken this as far as they can go in terms of their investigations. The PSNI seems to be saying that really in the absence of further information, they aren't able to take this investigation further, and so therefore they've closed or concluded their inquiries into this matter as well as the matter that happened in August.
Okay, thank you very much, Brendan. Just while Brendan was speaking to us there, in the last minute, the PSNI have issued confirmation that Bobby Singleton has been appointed as the Deputy Chief Constable. Bobby Singleton's been an ACC, an Assistant Chief Constable, for quite a while. This in a tweet: Chief Constable John Boucher has welcomed the appointment of Bobby Singleton as Deputy Chief Constable and has thanked Chris Todd for undertaking the role as temporary Deputy Chief Constable for the past 12 months. So Singleton becomes the new Deputy Chief Constable for Northern Ireland. Here's what the Chief Constable, John Boucher, has said: I very much want to congratulate Bobby on his appointment as the next Deputy Chief Constable of the PSNI. I'm personally really delighted to welcome him to his new role. This is great news for the PSNI. Bobby is dedicated to policing in Northern Ireland, and he brings a wealth of knowledge, skill, leadership and experience on the job. The board confirmed this 9 minutes ago at 10 o'clock. Bobby is dedicated to policing in Northern Ireland, brings wealth of knowledge, skill, leadership, experience in the job. He's already a key member of our leadership team, having joined the PSNI in the first intake of recruits after its formation. Like myself, I know that Bobby truly understands the importance and responsibility that comes with this role and what a privilege it is to be a part of this organisation. This is a super appointment, says the Chief Constable, John Boucher. John Burrows, who was a former senior police officer. So Singleton gets it, John.
He was the favourite. He came very close whenever they were interviewing for a Chief Constable. He was just in behind John Boucher. So I think it's positive now that we've got we're going to have a substantive Chief Constable and Deputy Chief Constable. Having gone through all of the turmoil last year, there's now a more settled leadership team, and I think there's now going to be some future appointments as ACC too. So it looks like John Boucher's going to get his leadership team up and running, and I think Bobby Singleton's a known quantity, and we'll see how he gets on.
Do we know if the two of them think alike, or will there be a little bit of maybe healthy disagreement there at the top, or are they aligned? Do we know?
Well, I think we've seen no indication of any discord between them, and we know that played out a little bit in the last senior leadership team. But you know, I would expect them to have a constructive professional working relationship, and any friction that might be there, professional friction, to be healthy and well managed. So, you know, I think it's a solid appointment, and I do wish ACC Singleton well in his new role.
What's the difference between a Deputy Chief Constable and an ACC?
Yeah, big difference, really. So the way the PSNI is organised, if you had all the different departments lined up, you have an ACC ultimately in charge of each department. So you'll have an ACC who's in total charge of local policing, so your neighbourhoods and your response policing, several thousand officers. You'll have an ACC in charge of all your specialist policing, surveillance, counter-terrorism, serious crime. You have an ACC in charge of like your operational support departments, your TSG, your road policing. Then when you move up one, the deputy is really then has overall charge of ensuring that the people in the organisation, the right policies are there. He's an overall charge of all the kind of professional standards policies, overall charge of all the governance issues and the finance issues. And really the job of the Deputy Chief Constable is to run the organisation and the people, the performance, the governance. And that allows the Chief Constable, on top of that, to really look outwards to manage relationships with staff and morale, manage relationships with external organisations like the policing board, and really look out and set an overall vision for the organisation. So the deputy is a critical post, and really it runs the organisation. He runs the organisation in terms of its governance, in terms of all its people and performance, and has an oversight of all of that, with supported by an ACC with responsibility for each department.
There's just I'm not reading into this, but it's a statement of fact. There's just one short paragraph, John, within this statement from the Chief Constable about Mark Hamilton. I also want, he says, to take the opportunity to pay tribute to former Deputy Chief Constable Mark Hamilton, who retires from policing later this year. Mark has spent 30 years of his life working to make the people of Northern Ireland safe. I wish him well for his retirement.
Yes, well, look, one wishes Mark Hamilton the best for his retirement. Clearly, you know, the issue of the Armour Road, and whilst we don't know what Mr. Hamilton went sick with, and that's his own personal business. We haven't seen him since then, really, and I had a very different view on how that incident was dealt with than he will have had. But on a personal basis, one has to wish him the best for his retirement and the best for his health.
And just finally, John, we have this, you know, Boucher's just in there. Long's he in there now? Is it guts of a year?
Yes, it is, yeah.
And Singleton's been there a long time, but now he has the power in this new job, certainly more power than he once had. Can we expect any change to the PSNI? Can we expect, and have we already seen, a different PSNI under Boucher and now the Boucher-Singleton duo?
Well, I think the differences we've seen with John Boucher is there's a sense that the ship has been steadied, and we have to give some credit to that to Chris Todd, who took over the temporary deputy, who mightn't be the most flamboyant character in the media, but I've picked up he's very diligent. He runs a steady ship, and he really got things back in a steady place. But I think the difference you've seen with John Boucher is there's a more assertive PSNI, more proactive. Starting to do things like pushing out images of mugshots, which historically they didn't do. We saw a much more forthright approach to the disorder that was linked to racial tension and immigration issues. He's pushed back at times at the board and simply said, we'll agree to disagree. Whereas I think in the past, the police have been a little bit supine. And I think he's reconnected with the rank and file. He said, look, very clearly, if you make an honest mistake, I will back you. Right, so go out there and do policing and do it honestly, and I will support you. If you're dishonest, we'll come down on you like a ton of bricks. And that's what the police service needed to hear, because there was anxiety in the organisation about being thrown under the bus, about being penalised for trying to go out there and do your job in a fast-moving incident. So he has more trust and credibility with the rank and file. So there is a slight difference in posture, and I hope the PSNI continues to support his staff better and actually gets back to doing core policing.
And finally, John, that's John Boucher. Of course, today's news is about his Deputy Chief Constable, Bobby Singleton. For someone that's been there a long time and therefore will know the rank and file, will know lots of those officers, will he be a popular appointment?
I think he'd be a popular appointment. He is seen as someone who understands the rank and file. He has come up through the rank and file in Northern Ireland. He's quite a young deputy chief constable. He might be one of the youngest we've had. And I think, you know, he will have a number of connections with the rank and file here. So he's certainly a very visible figure. He's tended to be accessible internally. And I think he speaks a language of common sense. So I think he will certainly get a very open reception from the rank and file. And I think they'll be you know, cautiously optimistic about the future.
Okay, you're going to stay with us, John, for the next item. Congratulations to the new Deputy Chief Constable for Northern Ireland, Bobby Singleton, 03030 80 55 55. Back to Roselawn Cemetery. John, you're going to stay with us. Councillor Jim Rogers, Chair of the Council's Cemeteries and Crematorium Working Group. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, the SLP Councillor Carl White. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. So Jim, here's the bottom line. How many of these officers will be now patrolling? And I'm asking that question because is it going to stop masked men attending funerals at Roselawn?
Stephen, I think it's important to point out that, and we don't want to allow this to get out of hand, there's rarely ever a display of paramilitary regalia at any of our cemeteries, including Roselawn, because the staff are very observant. They don't hesitate to take action if anything is going wrong. But in saying all that, it rarely ever happens, and I want to place on record my views. I'm totally opposed to any paramilitary trappings, whether they're at any of our cemeteries or wherever. They're illegal. and it's important that we move forward. And I've also got to say that Rose Lawn is very well policed. It's a large site, a very large site. We're in the process of building a new crematorium, which will have two chapels. The existing one will be used for other purposes. And it's so easy for people to run off at the mouth and make all sorts of claims and allegations about our cemeteries. They're well run, they're well managed, and the staff in them have got my fullest support.
So how many will be in the squad patrolling, Jim?
Well, it varies, Stephen, because you can't have people just standing in one place. They move around the site.
Yes.
And
is this a new security team?
Problems. Let's even talk about vandalism. Many cemeteries throughout the world have damage undertaken for some unknown reason. It rarely ever happens in any of our cemeteries or crematorium. So let's make sure that we don't get a lot of people panicking over this.
Yeah, but here's what I'm wondering. Look, if part of this security patrol is to stop that damage, and it's also to stop, and you're saying it's infrequent, masked men appearing at funerals, you know, is this going to be two security guards walking around the cemetery? And what are they going to do? What effect could they possibly have if there are paramilitary supporting, you know, masked up men standing at a graveside? What are these people going to be able to do?
You can rest assured that the police will be notified very swiftly and action will be taken. I think this whole issue's got blown out of proportion and we don't want that to happen. We want to make sure that people can go into the cemetery, whether it's on foot, whether it's on a bicycle, whether it's on a motorbike, or whether it's in a car or a van or a lorry. And we rarely have any problems or trouble.
Do you agree, Carl?
Yeah, Jim is right, Stephen. This is an important message he's putting out there. Rose Lawn is a very peaceful, generally, and serene place where people go every day to bury their loved ones and to have them cremated. So, you know, it's not like, you know, it's the Wild West. It definitely isn't, and the staff are doing a good job. There have been changes made since this incident. There's a more robust escalation process now, which enables the staff and allows them, helps them to get in touch with the PSNI much more quickly than and the PSNI are alerted much more quickly and there a lot more quickly. And that has been used on three or four occasions since this incident earlier in the year. I'm disappointed to hear that there won't be any prosecutions from that incident. And I think the wider question for the police is that, you know, when it comes to illegal bonfires in Belfast, the council has to get its own staff to remove them. When it comes to paramilitary displays at Roselawn, they're not investigating them, or they do investigate them, there's no prosecutions. When it comes to the removal of illegal flags, and they are up there illegally, the police shrug their shoulders. And recently we've had signs in East Belfast attacking Irish language primary schools, and the police wouldn't remove them. So we really need to think about, you know, you could put 100 security guards in Roselawn, and as you pointed out, they're not capable of tackling paramilitaries, organised crime groups, who, if they did that in any cemetery in Britain, the place would be descended upon.
Have you suggested, Carl, there are flags in Roselawn, or were you saying just around the rest of the community?
No, I'm just talking generally. No, okay. Just generally.
Well, John Burroughs, how difficult would it be for the PSNI to attempt to gather evidence leading to a prosecution for paramilitary-style supports at graveside?
Yeah, I think the key is communication. So, I mean, Carl's listed a lot of different things that are all completely, you know, different situations. But first and foremost, it is a serious offence. Section 13 of the Terrorism Act says it's an offence to wear clothing or display anything which gives the indication that you're supporting a terrorist organisation or that you're a member of it. So it's a serious crime. The PSNI did investigate this, but the difficulty is actually identifying who those people are, who was behind the mask. Now, the things you can do with if there's CCTV covering the car parks, you can then look at the cars and see who came to and fro the cemetery. But the issue here is identification. And what is absolutely vital is that if there's advance notice of this happening, or it's happening fast time, that the police are called immediately, the police turn up, and they can actually speak to the people there and then, and unmask them, arrest them, and take them away and prosecute them, or else get their details and prosecute them later on. But the key is you've got to identify them at the time.
Well, let's see if that happens. John Burrows, thank you. Carl White, thank you. Councillor Rogers, before you go, last time we were talking about Roselawn, we were talking about the unkempt nature of some of it around the gravesides and the grass. Has it all been cut and sorted?
Yes, the staff do their level best. As I've said earlier, it's a vast site and you're not going to please everybody, but we're doing our level best. And I've also mentioned about the new crematorium, which work will start in the early part of next year. And that's all positive. And our staff, and I will always defend our staff because I know how capable, how competent and how helpful they are. And I don't want what is been discussed this morning to be blown out of proportion, because there's absolutely no need for it, thanks to the good work of our staff at Roselawn.
Thanks for coming on as always, Jim. Thank you very much. 24 minutes past 10. Aye, the jungle is back. This year's so-called celebrities, Colleen Rooney, McFly's Danny Jones, Otti Mabuse. Who's that? From Strictly, former professional boxer, well, Barry McGuigan, the first Bush Tucker trial called the Mausoleum of Misery was completed by former boxing champ Barry McGuigan and McFly star Danny Jones.
Barry, tell me which padlock you're holding.
Number 5, isn't that right?
Yeah. Okay, Barry, number 5 is 8402.
That should be set on 4 zeros, so try and count them, Barry.
They're not back to zero, that's the problem, so I don't know what I'm doing.
Barry, which padlock haven't you fiddled with?
I fiddled with all of them.
That's the problem!
Now, Newton Arts Man, I'd never heard of him. Really, one DJ, Dean McCulloch, that's a generational thing, it's no slighting Dean. No idea who he was. Apparently, he's quite famous, he's a celebrity. Quickly teamed up with TV personality Colleen Rooney.
Barry, which padlock haven't you fiddled with?
I fiddled with all of them.
Agatha Christie, you're coming with me! Come on!
Right, so that's the same clip of what we just played. We'll try to sort that out. We're trying to hear from Dean McCulloch there. Commentator Emma Wolfe, former 2010 celebrity campmate Lembit Opik. Hello, Emma.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Lembit. Is the jungle still as good as it once was? Lembit.
It's never been as good as 2010 when, I happened to be in it. there's a certain arrogance whenever you've been in it. You watch it and you go, I wouldn't have done that. Oh, yeah, look how weak they are. So in that sense, there is that sort of thieves' honour when you watch patronisingly as these, as you said them yourself, so-called celebrities play the game. Where are the real celebrities? Take me back to the... I'm an ex-MP. Get me back in there.
This is from a man who described himself as a celebrity, of course, Emma, back in 2010.
Well, I'm not a celebrity. I've never been in the jungle. And you know what, Stephen? I wouldn't do it. When I see them eating the cockroaches, last night they were drinking fisheye cocktails. I don't know what was in there. All the things they do. Look, this is a bit of fun. It's a bit of light relief. But I do agree in a way with what you're both saying, which is, who are these people? The idea, I think it's a great format. It's funny. It's nightly. It's every night for the next 3 weeks. And, you know, last year when they had Nigel Farage, everyone was tuning in. But the problem is, it's called I'm a Celebrity, and I had to Google quite a lot of these people. Otti Mabuse is big. She's a dancer. Obviously, Colleen Rooney's the big name this year. They've paid, $1.5 million reportedly for her. But I do think they could make
million.
The effort to get bigger. They need to get bigger celebrities, because it doesn't matter what they're doing. If you've got big names, people will tune in. When you know, lots of people, as I say, were tuning into Nigel Farage. But when you're like, that singer from McFly, or obviously Barry McGuigan is a big name, but Talisa, I suppose she's a big name, but it's getting down, it's sort of starting to use the old random person from a soap opera that no one's watching, they need bigger celebrities.
I cocked up about Dean McCulloch, by the way. Apparently he's Newton Abbey, not Newton Arts. Here's a wee clip of him.
Agatha Christie, you're coming with me! Come on!
Have you ever driven a four-wheel drive before?
Yeah. I'm used to big cars.
Of course you are, babe. Yeah. Of course you are. I used to drive a Ford Fiesta.
Lambert.
Well, yeah, this is the problem. There are still some real celebrities. So why do they have these people? As I said before, it's generational. You should be in there, Steve, because you're a celebrity.
Nobody knows who I am.
Definitely watch every single, I think you are. And also, there are others. So I think, like you mentioned, Barry McGuigan, pretty well known, Talisa. But then there is Jane Moore, arguably. May not be her biggest fan, but she's kind of known. But that's not even just the issue. They seem to have gone woke. They don't have the stock politician. That was my role. That was Farage's role. That was Matt Hancock's role. Whether you like it or not, all of, I mean, Hancock and Farage really brought something and big debate to the event. But in fairness to the thing, as things develop, as they get hungry, as they lose, as they become attention deficit syndrome victims, it does get quite interesting. So maybe we're being harsh. I confess, I'll be watching it, if only to see who's sleeping in my bed.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing, Emma. Will you be watching it? Big Audrey was perched in front of the telly last night, 9 o'clock, to watch it.
Well, there you go. And if you are tuning in, it's a bit like Love Island. As you know, Stephen, I don't really watch television at all, but if you get into something like that, you kind of get hooked, you get addicted. And Lembit's absolutely right to remind us of Hancock. How could I have forgotten? And what was nice about having Matt Hancock in and Nigel Farage in was because you got all the journalists kind of watching so they could make clever political points, but you also got loads of people who are regular ITV viewers who maybe weren't that into politics, suddenly, you know, watching the debates about did Hancock do the right thing in COVID? What was Farage's view on Brexit? All of that. So you kind of get a nice cross-section. But I think they could up their game on celebrities. If you're going to spend millions, then up your game on the celebrities.
Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Lambert. That's it from us for today. We'll see you tomorrow when we have more Nolan at 9 at, guess what? 9 o'clock. Have a good Monday, everyone.